Good evening and welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club, and I'm your host for tonight. Our program tonight is How to Build a Great Company Step by Step with Steve Blank, serial entrepreneur and founder of Epiphany, professor UC Berkeley and Stanford, and author of the Startup Owner's Manual, in conversation with Daniel Lewin, corporate vice president of strategic and emerging business development at Microsoft. So I would like to thank you all for being here tonight. I'd like to thank our audience listening at home. Our program tonight is going to be a dialogue between Daniel and Steve, and we are then going to turn it over to audience questions in about 40 minutes, and we will end in about an hour or so. But I would like to thank you all for being here. Please use the microphones. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Daniel and Steven.
Terrific. Well, thank you. Steve, Daniel, here you go. All right. So we thought we'd kick this thing off by framing the broad question right up front, and we want you all to be paying attention and thinking of the questions that you want to bring forward, because that's a cornerstone of this conversation. But in the beginning...
Are you going to ask hard questions?
I am. All right. In the beginning, there was Steve Blank, the entrepreneur, without a business degree. Imagine that. And so I'm going to ask the basic question about, over the course of the last 5+ years, what do you know? What do you really know now that you didn't have a clue about as you were starting off building businesses? And you've done 8 businesses of various sizes, shapes, forms, and levels of success.
I think, you know, now you say it, and it's intuitively obvious when you say it, but I never understood, and I think as an industry we never understood, that startups are not smaller versions of large companies. That's a huge idea. That is, we used to say, oh, large companies, they write business plans. Startups, you go write a business plan. Large companies, they write a 5-year plan. You startups write 5-year plans. Mm-hmm. By the way, never ever noticing that the only other people to do 5-year plans was the Soviet Union, and we know how well that turned out. You know, startups, you know, large companies hire sales, marketing, and VP and biz dev on day one. You know, you do that too. Never quite understanding that the distinction between a startup and a large corporation is that large companies, at its core, execute known business models. But startups do something very different. Startups, in their early days, are searching for a business model. And this distinction between search and execution is what we now know is very different between an early stage venture and an existing corporation.
So there's a lot of accumulated experience that goes into this distillation that you just really so nicely framed.
That's because I've gotten it wrong a lot.
He's gotten it wrong a lot. So that's the first thing. Startups fail a lot. So what's the core question that people should be searching for relative to the business model? Because as you point out, at the end of the day, the innovation process is about economic impact. So it has to have a foundation and a business model. So given that that's the focal point, what's the first step?
So, it used to be in the old days you wrote a business plan. And a business plan is something you could kind of write in the library, right? It's, you know, let's do a lot of market research and look for data and how big is this market and put together some PowerPoint slides. And by the way, you know, let's have our, quote, financial plan in 5 years should say $100 million. I now tell my students that there's a secret Excel key code to auto-generate that. They're still looking for what those keys are. There's probably a lot of tech support calls into Microsoft, Daniel, just because of
sure.
me. But in fact, what we now know is a plan is just a series of untested hypotheses. And I use this fancy word, hypotheses, because when I teach at Stanford, those students pay $50,000 a year, and they need to tell their parents they learned something impressive at least once a week. But outside of Stanford, a startup really is a series of untested guesses. It's a big idea. A startup is nothing more than a faith-based enterprise on day one. It's faith. It's truly faith. And what your job is, another insight, is to turn that faith into fact as quickly as you can. So a startup, because it's an irrational decision. The odds are you're going to fail. But you do it because you're passionate, you're excited, etc. But the goal is to turn that passion and faith into facts as quickly as you can. And the organizing document I've adopted is not the business plan. It's something called the business model. And for the last 15 years, academics have argued, what the heck is a business model? You get two of us in a room and you come out with nine definitions. But about 4 years ago, there was a guy in Switzerland, Alexander Osterwalder, who wrote a book called Business Model Generation. And if all of you don't have it, you should. It basically says, look, any company could be described as a series of nine components. One is, what are you building? What's the product or service? He called that the value proposition. Two is, who are you building it for? Customer segments. You know, how are you going to get the product from you to those customer segments, channels? How are you going to create, get, keep, and grow? That is, how are you going to get customers, keep them, and grow them? We call that customer relationships. What's your revenue model? How are you going to make money? Do you need any partners? Are there any resources you need? Activities? And what are the costs? Every startup needs to answer those questions, ultimately to become a business. And the two most important on day one is, what am I making and for who, mm-hmm. which we call product market fit.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask that point, when you, does this apply to all businesses or is it just tech businesses?
You know, when I first started, I kind of thought, Daniel, this obviously just works for tech. That, you know, yeah, I've been in tech for, you know, decades and people I teach are tech. But it dawned on me only in the last couple of years that this idea of business model design and something I'll talk about called customer development actually works for everything we do that's a new venture. More importantly, it works for not just the 1% in tech, but it works for the 99% on Main Street. That is, if today you go to the SBA.gov site, mm-hmm. you know what they'll tell you? Here's how to write a business plan. It looks like the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And think about what that means. Is that, okay, write this document, you know, show me the market size, et cetera, instead of saying, hey, you want to open up a restaurant? Maybe you ought to work in one for a while. Mm-hmm. You want to pick this location? Maybe you ought to stand on that corner for, like, you know, with a clipboard. That is, there is no notion that any experiential effect is necessary. So this process works for small businesses, and it also works for large corporations. As you well know, mm-hmm. every major corporation in the 21st century is dealing with the issues of disruption,
sure.
right? Everybody. And the interesting thing is disruption on day one looks like a toy. Mm-hmm. In fact, the apocryphal or semi-apocryphal story I heard when I was in Finland is the day the iPhone was announced and shipped, the Nokia board was meeting, and they had it flown by courier mm-hmm. to the board meeting. And Nokia engineering had already built prototypes of, at least for hardware, something that looked close to the iPhone. And, in fact, they were in the board asking for $200 million commitment from the board to go make one just like it. Senior board member picked up the iPhone and asked the fatal question for Nokia. You know what it was?
No.
What's their market share?
Oh. Interesting.
What was their market share on day one?
Zero.
Disruption on day one to a large corporation always looks like a toy. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, as a large corporation, mm-hmm. you need a continual process to deal with not just sustaining innovation, as Clayton Christensen labeled 15 years ago, but you need a continual process to deal with disruption because it's only going to get worse in the 21st century.
So when you think about customer development you brought up, do you have a particular view? I mean, in the age of the web and the internet, clearly there's ways to go about reaching an audience in a friction-free way, essentially for free and at scale. But then again, there's also, as you said, sort of standing on the corner if you want to go build a restaurant. What's the implication of the current state of technology on sort of any business development problem
sure.
like this?
So let me put customer development in context.
Yeah, put it in that context.
So if you remember, I just talked about business models, right? Business model design, a company makes up nine boxes, et cetera. That's great, and if you like to do theory, you could sit in your office all day and draw up all the business model pieces. But if you remember, I said the fancy word for that is you just have a series of untested hypotheses. The real insight we now have after 50 years in Silicon Valley is that there are no facts inside your building, so get the heck outside. It's a big idea. That is, there's no doubt that you might be the smartest person in your building, but it is, in fact, guaranteed that you are not as smart as collectively all your potential customers. But in fact, if you are an engineer, the default is thinking that maybe more code or more features will solve a talk-to-the-customer problem. Mm-hmm. And some of you are actually like looking at your shoes being a little embarrassed right now. So the process we talk about to turn those hypotheses into facts is called customer development. And customer development says, we expect that your initial guesses, your initial hypotheses, are more than likely wrong. And that's going to be okay. But we're going to get you out of the building physically or virtually, if you're a web mobile app, and we're going to have you start interacting with customers as early as possible. And you're going to test two fundamental assumptions. One is your assumption about what the problem or need the customer has. Because when you started this company, inside your head you were going, yeah, we're going to solve X problem for them. Or if it's an entertainment product, oh, we're going to fulfill this need. Great, let's see if someone other than you share that belief. And if they did, now we're going to test the second piece, which is, does your solution solve that problem or need? That cannot be done inside your office. To answer your specific question, web, mobile, cloud apps allow us to get that feedback incredibly rapid, at a scale and at a speed never imagined. But the same process also works for physical products. It just means you physically need to get out of the building, kiss your family goodbye because you're not going to see them for a while, then spend a lot of time talking to customers. But even if it's web mobile, I have a philosophy that says you haven't validated your hypotheses until you've seen potential customers' pupils dilate, right? That is, unless you see them going, right? Personally, then all the market research stuff on the web, that's great. But unless you've cross-correlated that by having some percentage, say, grab you by the collar and go, you're not leaving until I have this app in my hands or I have this product in my hands, you really haven't gotten valid customer data.
So do you do that in the open or do you do that in kind of stealth mode, as people talk about for startups? What's the right way to go about that?
Well, the right way is the only way I could get you to do it.
So you must go through through this door.
Right. It turns out I teach this process not only to students but also for the National Science Foundation and people who have some serious technology who you would think they'd want to keep it all under wraps. One of the mistakes in thinking about this process assumes that what I want you to do is take your source code, your patents, and your firmware and share it with customers on day one. That's not what we're talking about at all. In fact, if we're doing that, we're doing way too much talking, and in fact, we're trying to sell something. My suggestion is we're not trying to sell anything at all. We're trying to do something that's very hard for an entrepreneur, and that's called listening, right? And that's called asking questions about what other people's needs are versus you trying to push, look, I just invented this. Don't you think it's great? And how many will you buy? Rather than tell me about your problems, or, how do you solve them today? And so the customer development process is not about, how can I take all my IP and dump it on somebody's desk and say whether they like it. Is that?
Yeah, so this is the two ears and one mouth chapter or something like
Something like that.
Okay, right. You listen and ask good questions.
And by the way, for an entrepreneur, listening is the hardest possible thing you could learn how to do. Especially, I'll tell you what's even worse. Imagine you just got funded by the best VC firm in Silicon Valley, or even better, Microsoft loved your product.
Sure, we love it. We love your stuff.
And so you now think your slide deck or your idea has been blessed by God, right? Blessed by God. And in fact, the only thing you need to change from your funding deck, instead of asking, I need $4 million, you now put in a new slide that says, I need an order.
Yeah.
Because the slide deck has been blessed. When in fact, all you did was convince somebody who actually just had a nice cup of coffee and he had gotten a good night's sleep to give you a check.
Yeah. Right?
But you're now believing all you need to do, fatal mistake, is execute your plan. This is where startups go wrong. They believe because someone said, here's a check, all you need to do is hire people, and somehow magically, because you wrote down the words, the world will unfold just per plan. We now know after 50 years it doesn't work like that.
So what's the culture issue then in an organization? Because, I mean, one of my observations, before I worked at Microsoft, I did a series of startups, and one of my observations is that the leadership culture, people mirror the founders and the leaders. And so you should be careful how you behave. It's not unlike being a parent, right? So the question I have is more around as a founder, you have to select some team members. Is there a right number, a wrong number? Are there strengths and weaknesses to consider as you bring forward the right mix for this level of customer engagement? Because
sure.
You're talking about this notion that you have in your book, which is terrific, about sort of how do you get to this minimal viable sort of place with your product before you hit scaling. So talk about the culture and that process a little bit for everybody.
So culture and people really do start with the founder, and it starts, though, with customer development in a very funny way. Because if you're a founder, you had to wake up in the morning with a vision and with a passion to bring that vision to reality. The bad news is that while you don't know it, I know it, you're more than likely hallucinating. Rather than having a vision, but let's just agree for a second, you might actually be having a vision.
Good coffee.
Right? And if you've seen that burning bush, you're just convinced that all you need to do is lead the people, through the desert and, take a left at, the burning bush and you'll be there 40 years later. But what you really need to know is there needs to be a little voice in the back of your head that says, what if you're wrong? What if you're wrong? And because we're driven by passion, that's not natural. What I'm suggesting is actually the unnatural act.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you how it usually plays out and what I, in fact, now insist happen instead. What usually plays out is the founder hires a VP of sales. Mm-hmm. And VP of sales, Daniel, get on, go talk to those customers. Great.
Absolutely.
You talk to a bunch of customers, and you know what? They say, Daniel, this is the worst idea I've ever heard. And if you're a great head of sales, you'll talk to maybe 10 more just to make sure, and you come back to your CEO, and you tell him that if you're being honest. And what's his first reaction? His first reaction?
You're not listening.
Yeah, you're not listening. You're not explaining it right, right? And something tells me you actually worked for somebody like this sometime in your career. You're just not explaining. They just don't get it, right? Right. So then he'll send you out again. Right?
Yeah.
You talk to these other guys, and it's worse. Now, in fact, they're really tough. And you come back again. What does he now say?
Well.
Yeah, what does he now say?
Well, you get a new VP of sales.
You bet. You're fired. No, sure. Not that you've never lived this, right? He's blushing because he has lived this.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't even know this when I started this discussion. So have I. Anybody else live this, right? This is a canonical model of what happens with a founder. Uh-huh. Now let me tell you what I do. You're not allowed to hire a VP of sales.
I agree with that.
Right?
Yeah.
Now you go out as the founder. As the founder, I want you outside the building.
Yeah.
At least 20% of your time,
yeah.
And I want you talking to those customers.
Yeah, this is, frankly, the Michael Dell story, if you haven't heard that. I mean, 20% of his time was listening to customers.
Yeah.
Direct sales model, listen to customers.
Now, all of a sudden, those customers are telling me the same thing. And you know what? Because I have such a reality distortion field,
yeah.
I'm going to ignore the first five.
Yeah.
But then I talk to another five.
And then another five.
And slowly smoke is starting to seep out of my ears.
Yeah.
Because cognitive dissonance is setting in,
yeah.
Right? I either could think they're all idiots,
yeah.
And that I'm truly the visionary,
sure.
Or I'm wrong. So part of the process for customer development is truly, no joke, is the founder needs to get out of the building with a customer development team, not sales, not marketing, and not think that all they need to do is execute.
Mm-hmm.
That's one idea about people.
Mm-hmm.
The second idea, and this goes back to what we learned, is the mistake that startups make, and I used to make this all the time. Big company exec, VP of sales, VP of marketing, big company, oh, look, I could recruit them to my startup because brand name and whatever, or I've raised money from famous VC X or Y, or they want to work in a startup. And almost 90% of the time, they end up as roadkill.
Right.
Right? And it isn't because they're dumb. It isn't because, they don't get how to work hard. It's just that what we have confused is that the titles, while the same, the job specs are radically different.
Yeah.
And we've never understood that. A VP of sales in a large company is executing a known business model.
Right.
A VP of sales on day one in a startup doesn't even have a roadmap.
Right.
It has a series of guesses. But
Yeah, it is. I mean, in a way, what you're pointing out is it's a set of accumulated experiences, and it's at different milestones, right, that individuals develop experience bases from which they can make change, because you're talking a lot about change, because there's feedback coming into the system. So talk about that change process.
So what we now know, and here's the story how it used to play out and what we've now come up with. In the old days, if you were a startup, you would do, you know, you'd raise money, engineering would spec the product, you go into alpha test, beta test, first customer ship. Anybody ever do that or hear about that? Right? It's a typical model. And somewhere around alpha or beta, you hire the VP of sales, and they bought into the revenue model because God itself has blessed it from some VC firm, and there it is, and all they need to do is execute it because it's there on paper, and they've signed up for that plan. Product ships. It's in all the blogs, all the newspapers. It's exciting. The first board meeting, everybody's high-fiving. The VP of marketing, VP of sales is sitting there. No one talks to her. Next board meeting. Now, all of a sudden, the board says, oh, yeah, how are we doing? And she goes, great pipeline. Right? Now, not all of you are laughing. Pipeline means that it looks good, but we really don't have any orders. We haven't closed anything, but it looks good. Mm-hmm. And depending on the economic climate, this goes on for either months or sometimes a year or two. But one day you open the boardroom door, and I don't know how VCs do this, but number one is you could smell the stench of death in the room. And two is no one is sitting next to the VP of sales. She's like by herself at the end of the table. And three, truly, it must be special effects, but they brought in a flaming sword right over her head.
Yeah.
And the minute she says pipeline, she disappears in a puff of smoke, and a new guy shows up. Now, this new VP, by the way, this occurs every 9.5 minutes in Silicon Valley. There's a VP of sales being fired. And in fact, they don't realize they're hired. They actually have a bullseye painted on their back. It's a bummer of a birthmark.
Yeah.
But this is, think about it. The second VP of sales is no dummy. They go, well, this strategy didn't work. But clearly, it was an idiot who was executing that. I'm going to come up with a new strategy. The only time we would change strategy in an early stage venture is by firing executives. Big idea. What we now understand is that startups actually go from failure to failure from day one.
Uh-huh.
And what we do is instead of firing executives, we fire the plan.
Uh-huh.
It's a huge idea. Remember that business model canvas?
Yeah, it's a very interesting point.
What we do is we now iterate or pivot one or more of those components of the plan. Just one thought.
Go.
It might be that the customer segment was wrong.
Right.
It might be we picked the wrong channel. It might be the product feature fit with the customers were wrong. Product market fit were wrong. That is, we now just embrace that we're probably going to get this wrong a number of times on the march of finding the definition of a startup. So let me give you this, because it took me 33 years to get to this sentence. And that is, what is the definition of a startup? What is a startup? And I finally came up with something that explained it to me. A startup is a temporary organization designed to search for a scalable and repeatable business model. Now, if you just deconstruct that, a startup is a temporary organization. Too bad, because it's kind of fun to have your dog and free food and whatever. But the goal, right, is not to be a 10-year-old startup. In fact, there are no such things. There are 2-year-old startups attached to 8-year-old failures, but you're having a good time, right? Designed to search, right? If you think about it,
the dog's not a puppy anymore.
Right, the dog has puppies themselves. In fact, you know, several generations of dogs. Designed to search. Your job is not to code or build product or even get customers. It's to search for something that's repeatable and scalable. We're looking for something that we could do the same day to day without special, you know, magic stuff and scales. You know, you put a dollar in, you get $3 out.
Right.
Right? And so what we're searching for is this business model, all the pieces. Now you have something to walk out of here with, which I know what I'm supposed to be doing.
But now you've got that.
Right.
So how do you grow it?
Ah.
Because there's a challenge associated with this initial customer segment. It's really more straightforward than not to have a small and important customer base around which you build a, say, profitable small business. But now you want to scale it.
Right.
So there's something going on. How do you do that?
Right. And that's the That's the secret memo that founders never get from their investors.
Okay.
So can I share with you the secret memo?
Yeah, tell us.
So it turns out that most founders never get to see liquidity of their own company. Depending on investor or venture firm, most of them get blown out, or, which is a polite way to say, replaced by their VCs. And ironically, of course, the most successful tech companies were run by their founders. Some of them had to be exiled for a while until they grew up.
Mm-hmm.
But
sure.
Others, like Bill Gates and Larry Ellison and Reed Hastings and Dell, et cetera,
exactly.
Still running. But most everybody in between never got the secret memo. And here's the secret memo. A startup, to become a company, really goes through three phases. One is the search for the business model. Those are done by insanely crazy people, where chaos is the norm, right? You're searching for one thing on one day, you're going somewhere else on another, your strategy's here and here. By the way, founders who come from dysfunctional families actually have an edge here.
That's
Anybody, some of you are kind of quickly looking around, going, seeing if anybody notices, but I'm talking about you. It's the first time in your careers you're going to have an edge because if you're a survivor of a dysfunctional family, you actually knew how to operate in chaos and focus on what's important.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, as an aside, it's why you tend to crater your own company when it becomes successful, because when it becomes repeatable is when you get incredibly nervous and actually have to create. Sounds like you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so just as an aside, the next step.
It's that little voice.
It's that little voice. The next step is the one that you don't get the memo about. And here's the funny thing. If you're a venture-funded company, let's just say you're lucky enough to get venture capital, you see one VC, one venture capitalist, every 6 weeks in a board meeting. What you don't understand is when they're pulling up in your parking lot for that board meeting, they have to look up your name. Because they're seeing, they're on 10 to 12 boards. And if they're super angels, they might be invested in 50 or 100 companies. They don't even know what city you're in. They like need GPS to figure out where your building is. But the day your company finds that repeatable business model, when you were thinking that you were going to announce in the boardroom, you know, hey, we found profitability, et cetera, you were clearing the aisles and actually handing out confetti for the parade they were going to give you up and down the aisles, all of a sudden in that board meeting, the VCs are staring at you in a way that's making you personally uncomfortable. And the reason why is now all of a sudden, from a startup who was worth nothing, you are now incredibly valuable to them, and they are looking to see if you're the executive to take them to what's called liquidity, mm-hmm. to take them to where they could actually take money out. And the odds are they're saying, he was crazy before, still crazy now. That isn't going to work. And they tend to look for operating execs. And an operating exec is someone who knows how to take a early stage venture and put in all the processes and procedures and the HR manual and the, you know, sales compensation plan and the whatever, where you were just happy, I don't know, here's the deal, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, there are some world-class founders who manage to make that transition. But most don't. And, by the way, some VCs are just happy to blow you out without a second thought. And while others actually are interested in career development for you, but none of them are ever going to tell you that when you're taking their money, or they're giving you their money. Because mm-hmm. if they said, oh, by the way, we're going to fire you, you know, you'd go to the next firm, not understanding that every firm is looking out for their liquidity.
Sure.
And so the interesting thing to remember is as a founder, your interests are aligned with your venture capitalist. Ironically, until you found the profitable model that is for your personal career. Finally, the next step is from building to actually growing and scale. And that may be the operating exec that took you from $2 million a year to $100 million a year, or it might be someone else who actually is much better at building the multinational conglomerate, et cetera. But there really, to me, are three phases to the company: search, build, and execute.
Interesting. So I have a question about the sort of reflective nature of a successful founder, someone who can transition the business, and because everybody here wants to be. How many people want to build a business or are building a business? Show of hands. Most of the audience. So you all want to be successful founders. So are there any things that you've experienced, and I'll toss something out there for you to work with. You know, I would argue, and there's lots of research on this, that there are not very many well-rounded individuals, particularly founders. Steve's already pointed out that if you're going to be successful, you come from a dysfunctional environment.
It's not a requirement.
It's not a requirement.
Some of you are going, darn, I got to yell at my parents.
So with that in mind, you can build a well-rounded team, though.
Yes.
Right. And so part of that is being reflective about your own strengths. So are there things, metrics, behaviors, things that you've been able to distill in your work and research and working with, you know, some of the new things you're doing with the NSF scientists, et cetera, you know, where they're deep in their science. And so how do they think about this process of building out the team once you reach that level? How should a founder think about that?
You know, one of the things I found, just personally, I did 8 startups, and I had 2 craters, one so deep it left its own iridium layer. That's and by the way, and that one failed just 100% based on hubris, mine. Complete hubris. I believe they're on press clippings, whatever. We were raising a ton of money. We were on the cover of Wired just as the company was going downhill. But it was great. It was, you know, felt great. Until, you know, like the guy jumping out of the 47th floor and somebody sees him at the 35th. How you doing? Okay till now.
So far, so good. So far,
that's how I felt. It felt great until, like, we went, oh, we forgot to make any products anybody wanted to buy. But the marketing was great.
Blame it on the sales guy.
It was always the sales. Actually, I have to tell you, if I could digress for a second, which I've been doing the entire evening.
That's good.
When I cratered, I blew $35 million. $35 million of investor money. First, you know, like, even I was stunned. I called up my mother, and who was a Russian immigrant, first-generation American. My parents truly came over in steerage. And I said, Mom, I lost $35 million. And of course she said, well, where'd you put it?
Where'd you?
I said, no. Mom, I spent it all. And then in Russian and Yiddish and about 4 other languages, none of which I understood anymore, she said, do you have to leave the country? I said, no. She said, do you have to pay it back? I said, no, Mom, the reason I'm finally calling you and telling you this is the venture capitalist decided to give me $12 million for my new company. And then she went off in a language I didn't even understand, so she finally went back into English and said, only in America are the streets paved with gold. But I tell this story to people who come from different countries or even different parts of the U.S. Mm-hmm. and, in fact, don't understand that the phrase we used for a failed entrepreneur in Silicon Valley and San Francisco is experienced. Mm-hmm. And that's something about the American culture that's truly American here. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been to lots of other countries. I know you have as well.
Yeah, I travel all the time, sure.
And while you could have the same human beings and the same whatever, but we operate in a spirit of that failure, an honest failure. I'm not talking about stealing the money or going somewhere else. Is failure equals experience, and you get multiple shots in this culture if you failed and learned. And so I forgot what your question was, but I wanted to answer that one.
It's more about, okay, so you don't want to fail. You want to win.
Right.
And you want to recognize your limitations, right, if you will. So that's the core of the question. So
in fact, let me turn that question around, because your boss at Microsoft, or your ex-boss, Bill Gates,
sure,
did this spectacularly well, at least from where I sat.
Sure.
Bill went through I don't know how many presidents, right, sucked them dry, and then got another one and learned from them. And I don't mean suck them dry.
No. Yeah. I mean, you know, I do have some experience in sort of seeing some of these things, and I'm not a student of the Microsoft history. I've been there for a while, but not in the early days. I worked at Apple and other places in the
early
days.
That's when computers had 4 bits, right?
More or less. It was the 4040 before the 80s.
Right.
John Shirley was the first and very important. Which gets actually into a question that I want to come back to about data and analytics, because John Shirley had come from Tandy Radio Shack, where they had lots of stores, thousands of stores, and lots of little teeny things that they had to count. And so there were clearly metrics that drove the management and structure of the company as it grew and scaled very, very rapidly. And Bill clearly knew, I wasn't there then, but he clearly knew that he needed someone of that skill. And so John, by all accounts, was the person who did that. Then there was another level of scaling after John stayed on the board. He didn't he didn't get used up. He maintained his rapport with the company at the board level. Bringing in Bob Herbold at one point was another who had come from Procter & Gamble, again, where Microsoft's an interesting company because it's not kind of a branded house like GE or a house of brands like Procter & Gamble. It's a unique unto itself, lots of different products, but, you know, an interesting company. And I think Bob, again, I think Bill was smart enough to know that he needed skill at that level. And that's the unique thing, I think, about extremely successful founders who stay on is that they recognize their strengths and weaknesses. They bring in that talent. And they learn, and sometimes they're done, if you will, after 3 or 4 or 5 years, and time's up because you brought in. And so then the founder, if they're really good, and you can see this in those that survive and rise to the top, then they accumulate that experience. Right. They know how to move on, and then they grow the organization to another level.
I thought Bill Gates did a masterful job.
And Bill was brilliant at it, no question about it. And then others need more total control and sometimes will flash and burn out and then can come back after they've accumulated. And you're talking
I think of Larry Ellison doing the same thing. Who's the Kleiner partner?
Ray Lane came in.
Right. Saved the company.
Oracle clearly hit a wall and they had business and business model and financial issues, et cetera. And then Ray Lane came in and absolutely fixed it. And then at another point, Ray was done and Larry's still running the business and Safra brought another discipline. So I think they're all like that. So I want to get back, though, to what's in your head about the metrics and the data, if you will, that can be important differentiators for a company. In fact, fundamental requirements. And you, with Epiphany in particular, had a lot to do with those kinds of things. So if you want to talk about how founders and startup businesses should be thinking about monitoring their metrics and the data and how that helps them beyond the people culture stuff that we talked about.
So, you know, in web-based businesses, it's almost criminal not to be collecting data and using it. But to me, the question is how and what are you looking for? And I tend to think of founders, world-class founders, are running a pattern recognizer full-time in the back of their heads. I just call it a neural net. And they're looking for patterns in the data. That is, this whole thing about customer development is I finally have figured out how to get founders outside the building. And then I realized, oh, I just got them standing in the parking lot. Okay, now I need to get them in front of customers. Okay, they're now, you know, in front of customers. And for a while, I had them, reporting back about every customer meeting, but not getting any insight. Mm-hmm. And what I realized was it's why accountants don't run startups. And I apologize for any accountants in the room. But at the end of the day, this is not about a spreadsheet, right? A successful business in an early stage is not about adding the numbers or about the number of customers. It's about finding sometimes it's the outliers. It's the people who threw you out. Mm-hmm. And they said, too bad you don't have X, I would pay $1 million. And you kind of laugh, and then so you're driving the car going, did he just say $1 million? We're selling it for $600.
Right.
And then you go back and say, can I find some more of those people? Or, you know, would you give me an order? And so, to me, analytics are just the beginning. Collecting this data is just the beginning, but it's not just to collect the data. You're looking for something that's just no one's kind of figured out. And this goes back to some of the successful patterns of entrepreneurs. People don't talk about pattern recognition. You know, we talked about tenacious and we talk about agile, but boy, if you're not curious and if you're not great at patterns, the odds are you shouldn't be a founder. Join someone else's startup because it's not about execution based on numbers. There are some corner cases where you could find those, but I have found the most successful ones, they thought it was over here on day one, and they see some other pattern over here, and that's where the business is.
I've had personal experiences of that ilk, and it's absolutely the case that, you know, founder's vision tied to a particular moment in time or a particular product strategy can be blinded if you don't don't listen.
And what's really interesting is about when you get one of these flashes of recognition, most founders take about a week or two until they could connect it to their mouth, right? I mean, you go in and say, we need to change everything, but, well, why? It doesn't come out. It's not coming out of your mouth.
It's a belief system, and you're changing a belief system.
But somehow there's something connected in the back of your head that, at least if I'm on your board, I'm going to force you to articulate what is the pattern you're seeing here. Because when we say flash of insight or epiphany, there really is a pattern you've seen, but it's somehow not connected to the conscious part yet. But we will get it out of you, and then when you're able to describe it to everybody, your company can follow.
Mm-hmm. So one other question in general that I think is important today, and then I want to turn it over to the audience, is all of this, in the modern world especially, factors in issues associated with, you know, say, compliance, privacy, intellectual property, things like that. So do you have any general observations about intellectual property issues and things like that that people should be paying attention to? Because sometimes people think the patent is the product or what have you. So,
yeah, I mean, you know, I deal with some of the country's best scientists in NSF, National Science Foundation, and some of the other classes I teach in Stanford Engineering School and at Caltech. But the issue isn't about how smart you are or about your technology. The business is about how does your technology fit with customers who will pay a ton of money for it, and how can you find a lot of those? So, you know, it's not just I have the best patent portfolio as a startup. That it's different if you're Apple or Microsoft or Google or Facebook. But on day one, it's not just about your technology. And in fact, for most engineers, that's really a hard thing to get over, is because if it was just about the about your technology, you're just going to need an extra room of where to put the bags of money when people show up at your door. And for some reason, it just doesn't happen that way. So what we're really looking for is the best match between your great technology and customer fit.
Got it. Perfect. Well, great. I want to make sure that people in the audience have a chance, so if anyone wants to start to queue around the microphones, I'd appreciate that.
Great. Thank you. And I would like to remind our audience listening at home that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. Our program tonight, How to Build a Great Company Step by Step, with Steve Blank in conversation with Dan LeLewin. And please step up to the microphones with your questions and make them good ones. And forward to hearing what you have to say.
All right. Ready to go.
Is that the best question?
Yeah, it is. All right. It's the first question.
I've got a hypothesis.
All right, perfect.
I'm John Wolpert. I'm one of the founders of Upstart Mobile, which we spun out of Best Buy a few years ago and makes Cabulous. And in the taxi industry that we worked in, we found that this was a very complicated customer environment. In fact, there's a bunch of customers, and they have countervailing interests.
Right.
Maybe this is the master graduate class of lean startup, is how do you get to – we found ourselves pivoting and pivoting and pivoting over the course of 2 years. I might ask you about pivot fatigue. And we weren't getting there until we discovered that really what we needed to do is go underneath the business model canvas into what we started calling the intention graph, where different lines of intent and intensity around those intentions were – created an interesting pattern, and we found a way through, and that's what got us to the next level. What would you say to that, and how would you structure that within the canvas?
I'd say it sounds like time for you to write your book. You know, one of the interesting things, and it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, is in your business you discovered that there were multiple sides to the market. Is that correct? Right? And so, you know, a multi-sided market means that there might be more than just the user is the payer. You know, the canonical model is Google search, right? You're the user, and you don't pay anything for it, and what you see is a search bar. But that's not Google's business, right? The business is actually not you. It's a set of advertisers who have, who, by the way, there's a different value proposition for, right? Google AdWords, and a different revenue model. Oh, and by the way, they have a direct sales force. And so now all of a sudden, just understanding search requires you to understand multiple sides of the market. But I'll make it even worse, though the taxi business might be the extreme example. Medical devices. You think, how hard could that be? I'm the customer. I need an artificial knee. Oh, I'm the user. Well, wait a minute. There's the doctor. Okay, another side of the market. Well, wait a minute. They can't put any hip in or knee in. There's the hospital. Oh, wait a minute. But who's the payer? Oh, the payer is the insurance company. Oh, okay, well, that's another side of the market. Well, wait a minute. There's regulatory. The FDA. There's regulatory, right? And then, you know, like, there's about five or six moving parts. So some markets actually are quite complicated. When you look at the canvas, it's this nice little box, but now you are color coding, because here's the insight. Each side of the market, each side, has its own value proposition, its own revenue model, and might have its own channel and customer relationships. And it's those intricacies that you were actually modeling, and they're influenced with each other, that I think you were working through. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so just understanding the fact that there might be multiple sides to a market, man, it really is an interesting graph. And if you were depending on one of the sides to kind of teach you about the other by sitting back in your office, No. As you discovered, you needed to understand all of them. Does that?
Exactly right. And anything to do with government
Yeah, I mean, what in many ways this is this notion of, you know, it's old things being done in new ways. So you have to chart this out and create the flow and figure out at every corner where the value proposition lies. Another question over there.
Hi, Steve. Thanks. So I'm what VCs don't want to hear in a presentation. I'm an idea guy. Mm-hmm. And my ideas have worked in corporate life for many, many years. You know, I consulted even. I've never built one myself. I have one I love. I'm about to build a team. What pitfalls do I avoid? What are any tips about building a good team? I don't have an engineer at my side who's passionate about my idea.
Does your product require engineering?
Yes, very much. Not really, really sophisticated technology, but somebody who I understand what tech can do. I don't understand how to do it. Mm-hmm. And I'm also a generation beyond most people in the startup world, which has some real meaning.
Mm-hmm. Though, let me start with your last observation. You know, I used to think entrepreneurship was about 20-somethings in hoodies and flip-flops. I mean, because that is the current, you know, perception of what entrepreneurship is about, and therefore I could be their grandfather. But it turns out that the average age of the National Science Foundation principal investigators were 48 years old, and their mentors are in their 50s. And we got them talking to 100 customers each in 10 weeks. They might die of a heart attack before the 22-year-olds, but they are capable of moving as fast and actually have more experience and wisdom than they do. So one is, let me just push back about this ageism. I think, as Daniel was mentioning to me earlier, yeah. Kauffman Foundation said the average age was about 45 years old of entrepreneurs in the U.S. as well. The second one is building a team and hearing you go out for the first time. You know, the first order bit, the first thing I would just remind you, before you commit to lots of team and energy, et cetera, is start testing your belief of the problem with people outside of your wife or your kids or your friends and see if other people share this. Now, by the way, I've said this multiple times. It doesn't mean that if no one likes it, you abandon the idea. Mm-hmm. Truly, this is not an accounting problem. But you should be able to explain why you're going to ignore all the data. It might just be because it's a new market and you see something they don't, right? It's okay, but at least, you know, say, okay, let me explain to you why I'm going to ignore the data. So my first piece of advice would be test the problem, test the solution. Right? And then test the solution is in the form of anything from a wireframe to a PowerPoint to a prototype to the, and this is the idea of something called a minimal viable product, of build not the entire product, but the smallest possible piece of the product that could get you learning and order, you know, revenue or something without going through the entire development process. And it could be that you might be the corner case that needs to build the whole thing. I have yet to see that except for an entire nuclear reactor. That's the only one where there's not an MVP. And in fact, even in Fukushima, they could tell you that isn't good enough.
And we need some new good ones. Right. Another question.
Hi, I'm Mark Rischer, CEO of Impermium. I love your story about the VP of sales and trying to accelerate sales too quickly. But at the same time, I feel that even if the founder and CEO is out there doing customer development, there's a need to try to scale that. And right. I'm wondering about experiences you've had where, you know, if Michael Dell is doing 20%, who's doing the other? It's not actually 80, but who else is doing this? How can you scale that learning right. out, not necessarily driving towards revenue too early, but right. at least so it's not just me taking every meeting?
Right. So, and again, I'm going to just remind you from everything I say here, it's not the way, yes. it's a way, okay? Mm-hmm. And a way to think about this is what you, the founders, are trying to do rapidly is to be the bow shock of what the sales process should look like. You're trying to validate, yes, if you do X and call on Y and, you know, Z, boom, there's an order. Right. What you're trying to figure out is what's the repeatable and predictable, not only business model, but now down to tactics, what's the repeatable and predictable sales model? Mm-hmm. And if you have a complicated sales process, you might want to hire first, not a VP of sales, but what I call a sales closer. Someone who actually might have been just a salesperson who's great at dealing with buyers or purchasing agents or whatever, that you could at least start them off and now hand them to somebody, you know, who doesn't want to be the VP of sales but can do the legwork. And then eventually, if you found something repeatable and scalable, you want to now start bringing on a VP of sales who's actually good at changing on a dime. And I'm going to give you an example. I hired at Epiphany, my last company, a director of sales from Oracle, Harvard-educated, top 10%. I mean, literally, it was the luckiest hire I ever made. And this guy, Jay Larson, ended up to have a spectacular career after I fired him. And the reason why is we were, like, calling on some early customers together, and we just got thrown out for the sixth time in a row. And I'm like, oh, and you know, it's rainy California winter, and we're in the in the car, and Jay's putting the key in the ignition. I go, Jay, where are we going? He goes, Steve, we're going to make the next call. I said, Jay, we were just thrown out sixth time. He said, that's why you were hired, an experienced head of sales. We have thick skins. I said, well, don't you think we should learn something from some? No, we're going to make the next call. And so as he's driving, I bring out my laptop, and I'm starting to type. And he says, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm changing the presentation. And the car almost goes off the road. You can't do that. I've memorized that presentation.
That's the problem.
Okay, that's the problem, right? Right there. My point is, you want somebody, even after you find this repeatable pattern early on, to be flexible enough to understand there still might be other money out there. I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah, I would say one of the things there is, when you hire people, you want to trust them, but you want to verify.
Right.
And if you don't get verification of what you believe in, your belief system, you got to change.
Right. How many of you are technical founders? Anybody in the room? All right. This is the biggest mistake technical founders make. I don't know anything about sales, so I'm going to hire a VP of sales.
Right.
They have a great Rolodex, and you know they came with great references. You're out of business. You're truly out of business because you will be BS'd to the rest of your life. Unless you have gotten out of the building yourself and been, and by the way, I could train engineers to do this, who the difference between an introvert and an extrovert, when I get them, is whether they're looking at their shoes or your shoes. And by the time I'm done with them, they know how to make eye contact. So I could teach anybody to do this, is I want you learning how to talk to customers. Because when your new shiny new VP of sales says, let me tell you how hard it is, you go, you know, I'm just an engineer, but I closed the first 10 deals. Oops.
Yeah.
Oops.
Right. Very, very good. Another question over here on the right.
Hi, my name's Paul. My co-founder and I are building a product that we, at this stage, envision selling to businesses. But we're wondering whether we can't learn a lot more right now by putting it in unpaying users' hands. You know, so can you validate the assumptions around the problem that you're solving without at the same time validating that people are going to be willing to pay for the solution?
No.
Yeah.
Let me add.
Except if you're Microsoft.
I'm not. It has nothing to do with Microsoft. It's something that we just did recently, but I think was very wise. Which is, I think, if you talk to Yammer, San Francisco-based company. Oh, there you go. I mean, the model was to drive viral usage, to drive paying customers. And there's something to be said for figuring out and interacting with customers in such a way and then providing a set of services. And so I'm not going to speak to their model, but it certainly worked for them. And I think, you know, it all depends upon your approach, right? So you can do it in the open. So Steve, go ahead.
You're digging yourself a nice hole.
No, it's not a hole. It's a good thing.
It is a good thing. And not to be facetious. I mean, there are cases where you could actually use a freemium model.
Bingo.
For a B2B sale. I just am somewhat old school in B2B in, like, I really want to know who's going to be paying for this stuff ultimately. And if you can't get anybody interested on day one as you spend time inside the organization, it doesn't get better over time. So if you do a freemium model for B2B, it doesn't mean you don't need to be spending the time inside of large organizations figuring out who's the user, who's the payer, who's the economic buyer. And by the way, in businesses, there's always a saboteur. And which never shows up in sales school.
They're not on the org chart.
Right, they're not on the org chart. A saboteur is always the one whose job your new product threatens, right? And they'll do anything to keep you out. And so you need to understand all this stuff, and I call it the order of battle. right? The order battle is different than the org chart. You need to understand the org chart, but the overlay is who has influence to who and what order do you need to penetrate the account, et cetera. Your job as the founder is to understand all of this so when you push the button, it becomes automagic.
Mm-hmm. Right? There are good models to pick from, for sure, and I think that's very valuable. Another question?
Hi. I'm doing some work with a company that's about 10 years old, and they've developed really well. So they came up with a product, they screwed up, they pivoted, they've built a market,
cool,
and they have a business model that's working. Now they come out with their second product, they've thrown it into the same business model, and it's flopped. And if you look at the business model that the new product requires, you can sort of see why. So big companies and small companies are different, but what happens if you're a big company that has to act like a small company? Microsoft could be in the same situation.
Yeah, how does that work?
Sure. I mean, you have market context you have to operate within, right? And any large company, and Christensen's books are probably the best, are trapped by the success, if you will. And, the approach to engaging your next generation business model has to be factored into, how you built your existing business, right? So in the case of Microsoft, the success of the company is tied to 700,000 other entities who do things with the products. Add value on top of the databases, install, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. So the new models, right, as you move beyond licensed software into software and a services architecture, software that runs on a device, if you will, and then a services architecture that loosely couples and interoperates, you do have to have a long-term view, a long-term strategy, and then it becomes the CEO's job to figure out the timing, right, on those transitions. It's a big pivot, if you will, for a shop the size of a Microsoft. But any successful going concern will be trapped by the model. And as the market context changes, and technology is certainly a key driver in that change, the internet changes everything. It removes distance. It removes time. It removes all kinds of things. And so there are fundamental things that you have to pay attention to, and if you're not paying attention to them and making decisions at those precise and right moments, which for a large company, the size and scale of $60-70 billion company, they can be multiple year periods of time during which you have to make those changes. And so that's certainly the case. So every company, the size and scale of the business will dictate how quickly you need to make those turns. And the smallest ones, as Steve's been pointing out all night long, are based upon how quickly can you do it effectively in real time till you find something that works.
So let me explain why it's even harder at Microsoft than it is in a startup.
Oh, for sure.
Because you fired all the crazy people.
Right. Or they went home rich, right?
In fact, that's the Google Facebook problem,
sure.
Right?
And every
the first
company goes through
it. They went home rich, or the other ones left, et cetera. And this is not anybody doing anything devious, bad, but in fact, how large companies succeed is they build execution engines.
Absolutely.
That is, people who are comfortable and organizations are comfortable, process oriented, doing the same thing day after day. It's how McDonald's scales and Walmart's. You don't want creative people in the back of every McDonald's making up new recipes, right?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, hey, let's try tacos today, you know? Or maybe at Walmart, hey, let's shelve everything alphabetically. I mean, it might be fun, but that would only happen once. And maybe chemicals were involved when they decided to do that. But the point is, truly, in an existing company, it's not just we need to find new markets. Is you got organizations and incentives in place and people in place for just pure execution, and now you're asking them to sing a very different song. Now I need you to be creative. And it's not like, what's that? This isn't an intelligence test, but you've selected for people comfortable in execution. Is that?
That's right. And it is an incredibly interesting challenge to make those things work. And small companies just have it in spades. Another question.
Hi, my name is Jim Bandrowski, author of Corporate Imagination Plus.
Cool.
Steve, huge ideas delivered humorously. Wonderful. I have a question.
You or me?
No, you. I have a question to Dan.
Sure.
Could you tell us a few secrets on how Microsoft goes about developing these emerging strategic business opportunity.
Did you pay him for this?
No.
Then pay him after, because this is a great question.
All right, so here it doesn't take. You were rocket science. That was one of your companies, Steve. So it's a partner built and driven ecosystem that makes Microsoft as strong as it is, and So it's the evolution of that process that is underway. It happens to be the work that I do, so it's a fair question.
Talk about
me.
Those innovation centers.
And so what we do is, on a global basis, our business is licensed software. The core of our P&L in a company is selling people a license right to software, whether it's Windows on a PC or an enterprise having the right to deploy all of our software and servers and those kinds of things. The world is moving rapidly to service-based capabilities, multi-billions of dollars of market cap being created, interesting companies being purchased for $1 billion plus that have service-based architectures. So we engage the entrepreneur and developer community on a global basis through a set of outreach programs. It starts with students where they dream and do interesting things, and we call it Dream Spark. It's a program where they can use our products in a way that is non-commercial, but anything they want to go do with it. And we have an Imagine Cup contest. You can find it on the web. And there are 375,000 or so students that participate in a global contest, and we award grants to them. They solve global millennium-style health and energy and health sort of social issues using technology. And then we have a program we call BizSpark, and we just let young companies, entrepreneurs with less than five-year-old businesses, use our technology at no charge for 3 full years at any scale, all they can eat. And there are communities of others, not us, but incubators, accelerators, small business administrations of whatever country or what have you, who participate in helping these entrepreneurs find us and us to find them. And we have a set of innovation centers. They're called Microsoft Innovation Centers around the world, of which there are 100. And you can find them on the web, and they're all unique to their local markets, and we don't do that stuff. So it's not commercial for Microsoft, but any company that is trying to reinvent itself has to look at its core, figure out how the context has changed, and then how to engage those communities and audience that made them successful in the past in and around the new model. So that's what we're doing.
And he's being modest. I've been in various cities around the world in things that weren't even directly related to Microsoft, finding they were sponsored by, right. by your group.
Right.
And this isn't an ad. It's just more of, holy cow.
Well, the rising tide of users of technology in building new ice cream stores or healthcare initiative is good for us. We just so we're all about entrepreneurism and sort of the global opportunity for this next generation of typically young people, but not always, to people with ideas to start new businesses. Technology is the essential enabler to virtually every business today, and so we do well when those things occur. So that's what we're working on.
Good. Unfortunately, we've reached a point in our program tonight where we have time for only one more question. I would like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California, how to build a great company step by step with Steve Blank and Daniel Lewin. I'm going to turn it over to an audience member for one last question, and then I'm going to come back to Daniel and Steve maybe to each make a closing comment.
Sure. Daniel, great BizSpark program. I'm actually a member, and I run the BizSpark SF user group.
Awesome.
So
thank you.
Great job. Definitely a wonderful program. I run a BizSpark startup, and we make a supply chain management solution. And we started off with one early customer, and we've kind of built that product around that customer over the past 3 years. And now we're getting out of the building and trying to sell it to other customers. And everyone says, wow, this is so awesome. It'd be great for our business, but we're not getting the order. So we're obviously scratching our heads. We are trying to be flexible in the sales process. Trying to validate some parts of our product, but right now we're hitting the brick wall again.
You're
and again.
At that moment.
And what should we do next?
Well, we're glad you asked that question. I'd be happy to talk to you offline, and I know Steve might have a comment.
Sure. So, one of the worst things that could happen to a startup is getting thrown out of a account with a smile. You'd rather people throw you out with a reason. But come back later, or gee, this is nice and whatever. But you, like your wallet's kind of empty. It's
they love the product. Yeah, they're like, it's so great.
So the answer is they don't.
Of course.
Right. right.
Only the buyers will tell you the truth.
Right. So let me just tell you the shorthand. Okay. The shorthand is you're looking to understand what pain you're solving and what gain you're creating for a series of customers. And if you can't tell me that first here's your hypothesis and here's what I've heard people tell me are not pains number, 1 through 49, but people tend to buy to solve their top 3, maybe 5 problems. So the fact that somebody said it was nice or they liked it, my next question is, where does this rank in the pain you have or the gains you want to create? And if they say, oh, it's the top three, then you need to be a lot blunter than you've been, clearly, and say, then wait a minute, I want your wallet. Mm-hmm. And you go, what?
That's the order.
I want your wallet right now. Empty it out. I'll put the money in an envelope, and when I deliver all the features you asked for, I get to keep this. Oh, I can't do that. Good. Now let's have a conversation of why not. Mm. And so you're, and I'm not being facetious here. You're being too nice of a guy, and this doesn't have to be a, you know, a painful
it's
interaction.
It's not contentious, right?
Right. But you can't leave with a smile. You've got to be a little more aggressive, inquisitive. You know, trying to understand. Where did you not understand? Because you're getting a lot of smiles and no orders. And this happens, don't feel bad, it happens to everybody until you get, well, wait a minute. You know, if I could like cash in those smiles, I'd be rich, but I'm going broke right now. Does that answer your question or
yeah,
not?
I'm going broke right now.
Right. So you need to, I mean, literally, I didn't do this all night, but you truly need one of these, right? In fact, come here. Here, I'm going to give you this one because this, come on, is this the most deserving guy of the night? Right. So, and, wait a minute. And then after you read it, you could buy me a cup of coffee, but, well, no, I'll buy you the coffee, right? And we'll talk about your problem, okay? All right, great. Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Our program tonight, How to Build a Great Company Step by Step. I'm going to ask Daniel first to just, and then Steve. Just can you just give us one or two lines,
yep.
140 characters on how to make it rich? And
easily done. So all of this is, I think, tied to a simple approach, which is your business is 10% what you're presented with and 90% what you do with what you're presented with. And what you need to do is in the book.
Is this where I'm supposed to say, and then you use Microsoft software or not?
I got him to say it. Even better.
And so my 140 characters, I said it while I was rambling tonight, but truly, if you take away anything from this evening, there are no facts inside your building. So get the heck outside.
Yeah.
And we'll see you there.
Yeah.
Thanks again.
All right, good. Well, I'd like to thank our speakers tonight, Steve Blank, Daniel Newman. I would like to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club. I'd like to thank our audience listening at home. And with that, we'll close this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened public discussion, is closed.